welcome to Unboxing, play and profit for the gaming curious. I'm Lane Nooney.
I'm Joost van Drenen.
And we are here digging deep on why games matter in today's economy. Hello. Good afternoon, Joost.
What's cooking? How you doing? What's happening? I like this sweater. That's not a holiday-inspired sweater. This is just loving anchors. Is that anchors?
Yeah, yeah.
That's a lot of fucking anchors.
It's a little knit sweater with little anchors on it. So, it's seasonal, but not Christmas. You know?
It's non-denominational, yet festive.
How are your Christmas decorations going?
Not well. I did make a Christmas piece. I beta tested a Christmas, like, you know, with the candle and like the branches sticking out.
A Christmas piece? What are you talking about?
I don't know. What do you call that in English? So like growing up, we used to make these. It's like basically like you take this big foam block of, and then what you do is you stick like little branches from a Christmas tree in it. Here, I'll show you. You see?
Oh, okay. Then, it's like kind of like a, okay, listeners, what he's showing me is sort of like a mantelpiece where you've kind of cover, you take an inner foam core and you cover it using, you know, holly and pine cones and fir boughs and things like that to make a sort of festive Christmas time object that you can put on a mantle or a windowsill or something. Yeah,
exactly.
I know about those. Yeah.
And I put some candles in it and like tiny little like ornaments. Yeah, I have like little, there was like little mushrooms. I also ordered like little deer, but they didn't arrive for some reason.
Do you, and little pine cones. Do you not do a tree?
I do a tree, but I wanted to expand the repertoire.
Okay.
I'm a man in his middle age, you know, just embracing my midlife crisis. So I'm like, I'm just finding hobbies.
Oh, podcasting wasn't enough.
Yeah, you know, I'm just building on the podcasting franchise. It's like, I'm going to start a Christmas piece podcast.
That's right. Next year, you can get your unboxing Christmas mantelpiece.
I know that's what people are really asking for,
according
to the Q&A. What's going on with you, other than the cool sweater weather?
Not much. My Christmas tree is already over. It sucks. I bought a Christmas tree the day before December started.
Oh my God.
Because I was going to have a party and I needed to get it decorated before I went into like full cooking mode. I think I got the wrong type of tree. I got the very classic Christmas tree, the very kind of with the classic smell and the thin needles that fall off if you breathe on it too hard. And I think those trees just really go down for the count really fast, especially in a New York City apartment that I cannot get to be less than like 75 degrees at all times. And so for 1 week, the tree looks unbelievable, like a platonic Christmas tree. It was one of the best looking trees. And then you hit like day 10, it just starts to kind of, it just looks sad. It begins to look really sad. Yeah. The boughs all start to droop.
No.
And it's like, oh, I'm just going to have a Christmas stick soon. And we're like 2 weeks from Christmas, you know? This ain't a good sign. This tree's going to look like, I might need to take this tree down and get another one before Christmas time. Because this tree looks like shit right now. I need to start getting a spreadsheet or something here to track my tree information so that I can make better choices. But
you boofed it. I'll tell you that.
I really did.
Christmas tree. It's remarkably difficult, though. I find that you're correct on the keeping the tree fresh. I find it very hard. I don't know what it is. Here in Brooklyn, I've had the same issue several years in a row.
I put water in it. It gets maple syrup. I'm not going to put white sugar in a tree. No, that's poison. And then you put lights on the thing, and it's hot all day, all night long. And because I like to walk out in the morning and see my tree lit, I don't turn it off at night. So that tree must just be roasting, like, you know, 16 hours a day.
This poor tree is working overtime. I do find some of the quality of trees wanting, to be honest. But the same thing with my Christmas piece. It's like the branches are already starting to fade. So I don't know. I don't know what the answer to that is.
Yeah, these are the early to mid-December problems. So
I totally agree. I feel a sense of melancholy arise just the same. When the sun is so low, like it is now, it's like I always get really introspective. So I usually am getting ready for my 10-day stretch of what used to be reading, writing, running, and red wine.
The four R's
of the festival season. It's the running is now the weightlifting. So that's different. I don't know how to put an R in that, but the reps, I guess.
Oh.
But it's like a this sort of whole like ritual of just like resetting for the year. What do you have been in store for New Year's Eve? Is that a big thing for you?
I'm going to be in Abu Dhabi. I have no idea. I leave the 28th or the 29th. I get there a day later. I don't think I get to have a New Year's Eve. Like it'll happen, but it's just like it's not mattering to me this year because I'm going to be literally on the other side of the world. There will be a 12-hour time difference, an 11-hour time difference between New York and Abu Dhabi. All I'm going to be worried about is being physiologically in the time zone and having this course ready to go because I'm teaching like 6 days a week out there. So for 3 hours at a hit. So
okay, so the new year will be a matter of indifference to you. I mean, you know, like I don't care much for the new year so much. Like this year, I'm trying to make something of it, but it's usually the wife. She goes in a party. It used to be like the biggest event of the year. I watch the kids. Just like leave me alone. Just leave me alone. I don't want to travel. It's the shittiest time. Have you ever been stuck at 5 a.m. in some party and you try to leave and you can't because there's no cabs? I don't want that. I don't like that. So I'm old and curmudgeon-y. Is there anything else of note that happened in the last week?
Not that I'm going to talk about on the podcast.
So it's for another podcast idea.
I've got, you know, private thoughts and experiences that I might share with you one-on-one, but not on the pod today. I do know, big on the pod today, we've got the extra special interview with one of the folks over at Minecraft. But I know that before we get into that, I just got a text from you that said, let's talk about why the Game Awards were so disappointing. And I was like, all right. I actually had forgotten that they were happening. Did you watch them when they were airing, Yost?
No. That's not my way of a good time. Did you curl up
with a nice liquor later on and watch them on 1.5 speed?
Just blast through it, me and Jeff. No, just off top, I think that it is, first of all, crazy that the games industry does not have an event that is self-celebratory in the way that the Emmys and the Oscars are, because people that make games are so deserving. So it's not for lack of that. But
there are the awards that happen at the Game Developers Conference, which I think are more like what you are talking about, but they do not command the level of spectacle that gets funneled into the Game Awards.
Yes. So this is where my ambivalence sits is the following. It's like, on the one hand, I think it's whack that we don't get more spectacle and wider recognition because we don't have a red carpet event on equal measure. At the same time, I also like that about the games industry that it doesn't have that, because whatever, like these are always team efforts. The idea that one person makes the best game. Yeah, I get that
so is film, so is television. Most media that are celebrated at these award events are also large team productions, right? There may be some core officers of vision, but you know, there's a whole armature of people scaffolding, holding all of that up. Obviously, I understand that there are production differences, but the idea that film is made by an auteur is also equally stupid. So,
okay, all right. I wasn't arguing. I didn't say that it was good.
I heard the slightest hint of coming from.
Let me get in there, Lane. It's like
I had to pounce. I don't know. I've already had a long day.
Shove this arid Christmas tree right up here. No, it's just culturally how I like it to remain different and also want it to be the same. That's really what I'm getting at.
Yeah.
And I don't know what the answer is, but I do know that the answer is not having the creative talent during the Video Game Awards speak the least.
Yes.
And the shortest. I thought that was a waste of everybody's time.
Yeah. The one thing that is distinctive about the Game Awards is that they are a marketing event in a way that the Emmys and the Oscars are not, right? It does just feel like an extended commercial, and yet this is the largest event we have on offer. I felt a lot of the issues got summed up for me in this excellent post on Blue Sky by the game dev James B. Jones, who skeeted, and I regret that is the word we have to use here, but basically he did an analysis of, he wanted to see what percentage of the game awards were the awards. And in his analysis, the Game Awards had a 3 hour, 34 minute runtime, of which 41 minutes and 29 seconds was devoted to awards. So that's about 19% of so just less than one fifth of the show is the awards. 14 of those awards were announced just in 4 minutes and 33 seconds. Meanwhile, Kojima got a solid 8 minutes 40 seconds to, you know, put on his tech demo on display, right? I mean, this, you know,
for a game that doesn't exist and also makes no sense currently. Right? Can we say that? I mean, if I hand you in a draft, like if I write on a napkin what I'm going to write a book about and you're a publisher, do you give me an award ceremony for 8 minutes? No. You're like, go write that fucking thing.
No, but it would be so. Like some, it would be like Scorsese showing up with a storyboard at the fucking Oscars. What are we doing here? I want to watch unedited previews of your next movie. Like, you know,
but that's, I think why, you know, at some point, and this is a question that maybe makes it too serious, but I think as the proprietor, like, Jeff Keighley has done an immense job, and I think he brings a lot of visibility to the industry. I think it's all very important. And at some point, like, he needs to stop being the main person in charge. Come on. Like, where's the committee of people that puts this together?
It's clearly suffering under his leadership, the sort of starstruck marketing jizz fest that the Game Awards is.
Wonderful is visual. Another great visual.
Really, you know, I always just like to tell you what I'm thinking. It really does just, it seems an expression of someone who feels very insecure about his status in the world. Mm. And I think we can just kind of move on. It has the potential, right? We say we want awards because they are supposed to acknowledge that games are, let's set aside art, just like a valuable cultural form of creative expression. And the reason we don't get taken seriously is this is what our awards look like. Mm-hmm. Right? Mm-hmm. Like we are literally defeating the very purpose of the aspirational recognition the industry desires when this is what you do, you know? When it just feels like you're inside a Doritos bag. Like, what the...
Way to bring that one back. Oh, that's cold.
That's right.
I know who's never coming to the VGAs and never getting an invitation, and that the person is you.
That's right. The unboxing cast will never get to sit courtside for the Game Awards.
I think that he thinks commercially very well. I think that he's also, if there's only, 41 minutes of actual people on stage talking and taking, like, saying nice things about each other, the rest was just ads. And so it's a two-hour ad block that I don't, just give me the summary. Give me the 20-minute version. And then, like, let's be about that. Then, but it's not actually a cultural event. But that should not be.
It's not a cultural event.
It's a for profit.
Maybe it is in the word. Maybe we get the culture we deserve in games. But it's not moving the needle, right? To think a bit about our interview with David Nayberg, right? If you want games to quote unquote be mainstream, if you want a shared lexicon, this is a terrible business card for getting anyone outside of games to give a fuck about what we do. Because it does look like it's run for children.
Yeah, I'm just not super impressed. And I think that the industry can be much more highbrow. And it's, I don't know. But whatever, it's not up to us. Nobody cares. I want to talk about one or two more things before we dive into this interview with Kayla Kananen from Minecraft. The first one is the game launch for the day before.
Okay.
I don't know if you read into any of that.
I did not. You just typed the day before into our Discord, and I was like, what are you talking about?
Okay. The day before.
Sometimes this, let me lead it in. This man is so hard to work with sometimes.
I mean, look, why don't you know this? Is really the question. So the day before is a game on Steam, or rather was a game on Steam, that was much anticipated, made by a developer called Fantastic, but poorly spelled, so it's F-Fantastic. And it's a shooter adventure, survival horror, a looter shooter, if you will. So a lot of people were waiting for a long time to get this game. It finally releases. It has the sort of vibe that you would imagine somewhere between The Division and The Last of Us. Zombie apocalypse, you walk around multiplayer, there's sort of like zombies, and then you collect weapons and you like tear through this cityscape or whatever.
1 star on Steam.
Yes.
Did I just steal your thunder?
It gets worse. So it's not just 1 star, it's also like almost half of the people that bought it requested a refund within 48 hours. So it's just like this incredible, disappointing release.
What went so bad?
The game is terrible. It's just really bad. The game is just really not fun. And so what you see is like this attempt to really borrow from existing genres to set the mood and to piggyback off of what people ostensibly, and it just tanked. But not just that the game failed, the studio is now shut down too.
Yes. I'm reading the release announcement about this that was on Twitter.
And so it's just, you know,
The Day Before has failed financially and we lack funds to continue. All income received is being used to pay off debts to our partners. We really wanted to release new patches to reveal the full potential of the game. Fortunately, we don't have the funding. We didn't make any money from the public during the development of The Day Before. There were no pre-orders or crowdfunding campaigns. A lot of people in these reviews are calling it a scam that, you know, they took advantage. Is this a bunch of people got, you know, was this scammy or was this just they made something that really sucked and didn't seem to realize it?
I mean, look, let's assume that if people spend 5 years working on something, that a team of people does that, that at least some of those people showed up to work every day with the intention to make something worth playing, right? It can't be that everybody's like sitting there like, let's go screw people out of $39.99 on Steam. What I do think is that people tend to pile on. People love the hate. Yeah. And Steam is an unforgiving marketplace.
Yes. Yeah, so people extrapolate this. So some of these reviews are saying this is not an open world MMO. This is a small area extraction shooter. So big swing and a miss difference between scale promised and scale delivered.
So apparently there was over 200,000 buyers and 92,000 refunders. Almost instantaneously. And that just kills the business, of course. It has 19,000 negative, overwhelmingly negative reviews. For all the accusations of rug pulls in Web3 gaming, some people use that same vernacular to describe this one. Calling it a scam, like you pointed out, it's the lowest rated game of all time. You know, you have to wonder, like, where did that break down? My guess is that they just saw the end coming in terms of money and just hurried to the finish line, got it out. And then it sucked. And then everybody's, yeah, we don't want this. And now because you've stretched yourself so thin financially, for whatever reason, mismanagement or just that's what it costs,
yeah,
doesn't really matter why, now the whole business is gone, right? And so I can't imagine spending 5 years on a project and to get this kind of reception. Talk about an award show, like, Jesus. it's like, what a gut punch. You've written and published a book, like when you have a major enterprise like that and then to just like get kicked in the stomach, like, come on. So I feel very bad for them. Also, it shows you the risk profile. That's really the rational component here, right? It's not just let's make a game that looks like some other game and hope it works. It's 5 years and all this effort and time and money. If it fails, your company's out of business. You don't get another shot at this. So the stakes for small and medium-sized game studios like this are incredibly high. I had a conversation earlier today with someone who reminded, when you talk to EA, when you talk to Take-Two Interactive, whatever, these large AAA publishers at the top of the food chain, look, they can't really afford too many negatives in their profile either, but they could survive, right? They would know, perhaps, they could at least fund it long enough to get it to like a publishable quality level. But some studios just, they run out of money. And then they're just like, look, we had to publish this on Friday or we don't. Either way, we have to take a shot. And so it's just not as insulated and financially buffered to put up with, to assume this kind of risk. And so they just go out of business. It's just brutal how that could work out.
Incredible. For the opposite end of the story, a game that is doing remarkably, perhaps unexpectedly well, is Lethal Company. Have you heard about this from your students?
Lethal Company, I have not heard of
this. Yeah, so it's created by one dev, who works under the name Zeekers, and they've published some other stuff, but my students are crowing about this. Everyone is super excited. It is described as a co-op horror about scavenging abandoned moons to sell scrap to the quote-unquote company.
It looks somewhere between Among Us and Skibidi Toilet. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think it's
Jesus. These are some amazing graphics.
People are loving it. People are loving it.
I'm not hating. It's like, you know,
overwhelmingly positive reviews, you know. Mm-hmm. Online co-op horror, first-person exploration. People are really digging this, and only $9.99 on Steam. What you might do with that day before refund is go and spend just a quarter of it picking yourself up Lethal Company.
These are your gameplay things.
No part of this discussion was paid for by Zeekers.
That's fantastic. I love how you turned that around. That's really well done. Okay, so that's what you're playing tonight. Anything else in the docket today?
I think that's it.
And nothing else to do. Let's move to the interview. So the series of inquiring interviews that we've been running has been around the creator economy and figuring out the degree to which that actually makes sense or what that model looks like. When you ask different companies, we heard from Roblox before. This time we're going to talk to the people at Minecraft. I'm always very curious to see, particularly like how they use, like what words they use to describe and explain this. What is it that in their mind is foundational to the model? Roblox, as you heard, doesn't consider itself so much a game anymore. It's more like an online world. And they have this, from the sense of platform holders, they see themselves as a platform, but they don't want to make any first-party content. They really want to hand it over. Epic Games is transitioning its economic model. It let go of like all these people a few months ago. And part of that was its transition to a user-generated content model or creator economy. And so everybody's giving or manifesting this different ways. But the OG is, of course, Minecraft, right? If you even talk to like a general media executive that doesn't even have children that play games, they will still understand Minecraft, right? It's such an obvious presence in the industry that not only is well known, but it really introduces these new concepts to people that previously hadn't considered them at all. And so I think that that's really one of the things that kind of makes them incredibly popular, but also very useful in the conversation. So I was very excited to be able to speak with Kayla Kinnunen from Minecraft, who has a long history in the games industry and eventually ended up in this position. The interview took place in August, September, and it was interesting to see because a lot of the world announcement that we hear today weren't public then. I'm hoping you'll enjoy this. I thought it was a very interesting conversation, and I'll see you on the back end when we discuss it a little
later. Amazing. Let's roll that tape.
Thank you for joining today. I'm very excited to speak to you about your work experience and the general thing that you're working on, which is the overarching topic of user-generated content. Obviously, and you can correct me on all of these things, but as a sort of executive with 20 years of experience, it seems to me, looking at your history, that you've had a really privileged and unique perspective, right? Working with EA, Microsoft, Mojang. I've watched some of the talks you did. You did a post-mortem on Warhammer 40K Carnage. I'm a big fan of Warhammer, to be honest. And it was really interesting. That was 2014.
Yeah, so that was a long time ago.
A decade ago. But it tells me as much that you've been in the trenches and you've tackled the good and the bad of making games. And since then, really achieved a position in the games industry where you now have this ability to transform, right? And I think the moment in the games industry where we've arrived is that gaming today is demanding new affordances, new things for people mm-hmm. to do and play. Mm-hmm. And user-generated content is one of those avenues. So that's really the topic that is interesting to me, to which I think you can speak uniquely. Just as a sort of short background for my own information too, Minecraft has generated, $3 billion in-game sales. It's a huge audience. I think the last number I read was 238 million monthly players worldwide. I think that's a number from 2021. I'm not asking you to confirm or deny any of that, but that's like my headspace when I say it's a big deal, also because it reaches different platforms. So just to get a sense of what that looks like on your end, can you give me a little bit of background on what your daily responsibilities are, what your role is within Mojang and Minecraft more generally?
Yeah, certainly. So I am the executive producer of what we call the Minecraft Creator Platform. And I like to say that my job is twofold. One is we always want to make our platform more capable. And so I really want to make sure that our creators are feeling not constrained by the platform, that their creativity can really be expressed more fully, that they can always do more, they can tell better stories, tell more immersive stories, entertain our audience in a better way. So first thing is really just making sure that our platform becomes more capable over time. And the second thing I really worry about is making our platform more accessible, more inclusive, more approachable for more people. So that's like lowering the floor so that more people can come in. We really believe strongly that a great creator can come from anywhere. And so we really want to make sure that we're widening the net and making it so that anyone feels like they could be a creator and they can get started with our platform.
I'm biased towards user-generated content in general. I think it's in my world of, you know, academia and economics to some degree, most people will regard like the great designer, this authoritative voice, is that's the way to make games, right? The some mostly middle-aged white men making a game because they're so brilliant. And then that's really like the Will Wrights, who in and of its own is of course a brilliant creator, but it's like it creates this persona of a single individual making these massive universes. But the professional development of gaming is one thing. I've always been so curious. Once you hand people the tools, that's much more interesting, I think, from a cultural perspective, but also from an expressive perspective. I've done some research around Command and Conquer Generals, and you look at the message boards and the kind of mods that people create in the context of a game, and then really about what stories do they tell each other? What motivates them to make these things? How do you describe the evolution of the games industry? How do you look at the last 20 years and how things have changed?
Yeah, it's interesting you bring up the auteurship of games and that magical idea that this kind of brilliant designer is making these games. And I started working in games at Electronic Arts back in 2000, and I've never really worked on like a game that was the vision of a single person. I was always working with teams, and that's that kind of feeling of games coming together as the collective joining of technology and artistry and people is really what kind of is magical about the games industry. Is it really isn't the creation of a single person. It is the creation of multitudes of people. And the magic of games really tends to come out in that messy collaboration bit. So while it's nice to kind of mythicize this kind of origin story of games, the reality is I've never really witnessed that kind of mystical thing. The reality is really people working in the trenches and getting stuff done. But like I've seen the transition from various consoles. So I started PS2, Xbox, GameCube launch era is when I started my industry. I saw the switch over to digital. I saw the switch over to online, switch over to mobile. I saw the movement into free-to-play, all these different evolutions that have happened over the industry. And that's really changed a lot of who has access to make games over this period of time. So back when I first started, you had to work for an EA or you had to work for a big company in order to actually get a game out there. You needed distribution, you needed publishing, you needed expensive hardware and technology to make stuff happen. But those barriers have really come down a lot over the years. Thinking back to the, I was really into the flash gaming industry, and I have met a lot of friends who got their start making flash games back in the 2000s, because the barrier to entry there was so low that anybody could get started. The tools were easy to use, it was easy to publish, right, and then easy to reach audiences because the games would be broadly accessible. And so really what I think we're seeing in the UGC side right now is kind of continuation of that, where these larger games like Minecraft can transform themselves into be more of a platform. I can offer tooling and can offer capability where new generations of creators can come in, leverage those things to express themselves in a way that's more approachable than maybe learning a brand new game engine or building your own game engine might have been in the past. And because these games already have an audience and a reach, as a creator, you can build these experiences and connect with an audience in a lot more direct way. And so I see this kind of evolution over time where things are getting easier for more people to become creators of games. It's coming a little bit easier to connect with players. And there's these just new channels that are opening up over time.
I imagine that the way that particularly user-generated content has evolved and it's become less and less, the tools are more readily available. It's much more intuitive. I have a 10-year-old at home and he loves nothing more than to just tinker and just figure stuff out, right? He just goes and he builds a few things and he's not quite there yet where he wants to go and open his own little store or whatever. Mm-hmm. But it's increasingly part of the vernacular of these large multiplayer online games, right? Minecraft does it. Roblox does it. Fortnite's doing it. In many ways, I regard that as like a next avenue of growth, the next avenue of differentiation for these worlds, because historically in entertainment, yeah, the problem was always if you like Star Wars, but you want to then go and take a sheet of paper and do the outline of Han Solo and make your own fan art around it, this sort of folklore approach to it, IP holders don't like that so much. So it's in gaming, however, in these massive universes, it's a key piece of self-expression, of just participating, of really socializing. How do you see that evolve? It's a bit of a forward-looking question, but how do you see that universe in the next, say, 5 years develop?
I think I'm going to start by going back on that one right there. So your idea of people getting obsessed with the games that they're playing, I think it was Steam Dev Days in 2014. There was a talk there on UGC, and the lecturer there said that if a player loves your game, they're going to mod it. So you might as well make it easier for them. And I think that holds true right now as well. As a player, if you are really engaged and you love a game, you're going to want to spend more time with it. You're going to want to get more obsessive with it. You're going to want to make it your own. You're going to want to find ways to find your own creative expression within it. And so I think that's the opportunity right there, is how do we as game makers allow for that level of expression, regardless of where those creators are on the spectrum, whether they're just kind of player creators and they just want to make their own mobs or make a little item in the game, but just do something that kind of makes it feel a bit more their own, or on the other side of the spectrum where they want to extend the game and make full-on game experiences that have revenue opportunities that they can share in the success of things right there as well. So like, how do we extend that? And I think forward-looking, it's hard to predict where we're going to go, but I definitely see that I still feel like we're in the early days of this shift in the games industry, where I think the opportunity for game experiences to live inside these kind of, I guess, IP or whatever, is just going to continue, and the types of experiences that we see in them are going to be better. Like back in the day, you could mod a game and that game could be successful, and you know, League of Legends started as a mod, Counter-Strike started as a mod, and you had these kind of good games that did that. I think it's just a matter of time before we see the next big game emerge from within these platforms. So you'll see these game platforms have a internal game developed that becomes big in its own right that people glom into.
That's a good prediction, right? It's like the next billion-dollar franchise or the next billion-dollar game will emerge from user-generated activity somewhere inside of an existing universe. Even a Fortnite really was an iteration that borrowed from PUBG, which is an unemployed photographer tinkering during his depression, really. And so you can see how that creates a moment where somebody's going to have an idea and it's going to just take hold somewhere. And then within an existing ecosystem, that's when it really takes flight. I think we're there, where you have these semi-professional or quasi-professional game makers inside of Minecraft or Roblox, and they build something that's going to be so popular and so well-polished that it just makes no sense as a publisher yourself to pursue something similar. You couldn't hire against that. I spoke with EA on some of this, and they say, look, we have amateur creators producing 6 times the content that our entire professional development team does. So it's just impossible, just numerically, to take as many shots on goal. It's just that the innovation will come from that rather than some team with diplomas and experience. But it leads to a few questions that I think are a little bit critical. As a dad, I look at my kid and I get this question a lot. What do you let your child play? What's good? What's bad? Should my 10-year-old be creating monetizable content for a publicly traded firm?
I'm not saying Microsoft or Roblox, but I'm just in the corporate context, how do you navigate that? Like, how do you answer that question?
Yeah, and I think that kind of speaks to one of the differentiators that we have on Minecraft and how we think about our cohorts of creators and how we handle monetization and how we are really tightly controlled in terms of how we handle monetization with our platform. I think I could start with a bit of how we think about cohortizing our creators. So I think about our creators across three different cohorts. I think about them as player creators. These are people who are just emerging, beginning their creator journey. They were players, but now are tinkering. They're trying to make their own thing. They're probably doing it because they want to see what they can do, or they're doing it for their own entertainment, or they're doing it because they want to impress a friend. But these kind of player creators are at the start of their journey, and they're just playing around. The next cohort is what I would call hobbyist creators. These are creators who are now spending a significant amount of their spare time building experiences on our platform. They're doing it probably in a communal way where they're trying to build status within the community. These are the folks that I'm probably chatting with on Discord who are giving me feedback on every new feature that we release. They're listening to all my Twitter messages about new updates. They're really they're really passionate about what's happening, but they're really motivated by status within their own community, and they're motivated by growing their own skill set over time. And then the third cohort is what we would call our professional creators. And these are the ones that their motivation is they want to earn a living wage. They want to pay rent. They want to keep their business afloat. They're trying to build content so that they can support themselves, support their families, support the businesses that they're operating. And so their motivations are quite different than the others. But you know that there's only that one cohort that's motivated by money. The other folks are not. The motivations are a lot more intrinsic. And so as a platform, we try to then not focus on the money. So I don't want to focus on telling a 10-year-old you're going to make $1 million making Minecraft content. I would much rather engage a 10-year-old and be like, the joy of creating content is really fun, and you should get started and look at the cool stuff you can do, and just find joy in that. And then if they keep at it and they still feel passionate about it, and you know, down the road, they may decide that they want to try to do that more seriously and more professionally. We have hundreds of professional creators that are making content and supporting themselves and their families with it. But we have many thousands of other creators that are just creating content without the idea of monetization in there. And so for us, we heavily monitor who that cohort of professional creators are. There's a full approval process to get into that program. We keep the numbers controlled in there because we want to make sure that we maximize the outcomes for those creators and make sure that we're taking care of them and making sure that we can have the capacity to review all the content that they make. Because again, we want to be very protective of the Minecraft IP brand and make sure that any of the content that they make is something that we would be comfortable with any of our player base playing.
I should add to this is that I've always been a fan of Microsoft in that because it's such a large company, it's most likely to catch a lot of flack. And unrelated to this conversation, this whole acquisition of Activision is just like everybody's just taking a stab at them. And so it's not in the nature of Microsoft to take a risk on monetizing children because it would immediately shut down its $1 trillion empire. Nobody would want that. And so it has the most to lose as opposed to a much smaller firm that's privately held and so on. So I believe that the policies that Microsoft instills and sets up are actually hold water in that sense. It seems very intuitive to match up cohorts with the degree to which people are engaged. So children should be able to play and experiment and socialize freely without any kind of profit motive. And most of them do. That's part of the experience. It's being on an average playground, it's okay, we're making up a game or we're playing something that is totally emergent in some ways. But I'm the game leader. I'm the one who's counting down or finding everybody. The same way on the other side of the spectrum, you could say, okay, we want to have some professional sort of gray layer. They're not Microsoft employees, but they make content for the asset. But that's a very different approach. And you can monitor and basically award, I imagine, certain certificates or a developer license that allows them to do these things commercially and at scale. I like the cohort structure, and I think that makes sense in the larger policy.
No, I'll say on that one. The cohorts aren't just kids either, right? Like as an adult, even, I loved doing game jams. I loved just making games for the sake of having fun making games and not having to worry mm-hmm. about the financial aspect of it. So those cohorts aren't just kids' cohorts either. As an adult, you could be playing Minecraft and you could be a player creator and you could just make content for fun. There's lots of adults that are hobbyist creators right now as well. I just think as humans, we don't always need or want to be money focused or money motivated on things. That there's a lot of other motivations out there that could drive our behavior. And so it's not all about the money. Like making content shouldn't be all about the money. It should be intrinsically joyful, intrinsically fun. Right. It should appeal to basic human desires that we have. And then for where it makes sense, then of course we want to find a path where people can mm-hmm. make an income on these things.
I subscribe to that idea. There's an area there where you say, hey, my 10, 12, 14-year-old should have the ability to run a lemonade stand. We romanticize that notion because here's a child and they're learning about money and responsibility. Okay, what's the digital equivalent of that? I think it speaks to that in some metaphorical way. One additional component, and I think Minecraft has answered this years ago. This was during the Game Developers Conference a few years ago. Somebody introduced this term to me, and now I can't let it go. It's called TTP, time to penis. So I know Minecraft manages this as well because you don't really see that much of it. But so what's the secret sauce, or how do you at this scale manage to avoid any kind of, the world is not, it's not just digital genitals. It's also extremism and all this other crap that regulators who don't understand the industry worry about. How do you manage that at scale? What's the approach to content moderation while still retaining creative freedom?
Yeah. Again, coming back to our overarching way that we approach content is the marketplace content that you see in the marketplace is all mm-hmm. reviewed by humans and reviewed by us and approved to go up in the marketplace. Those creators that are professional creators that we've signed as the program have to abide by content guidelines in order to submit content there, and they have a lot to lose if they break those guidelines. As a player, you can only easily access that marketplace content. Mm-hmm. That's the content that we show to players. So that means that all the content that is easily viewable by players is that stuff that's heavily moderated, and that's the best way to create that kind of safety for our player base. We don't stop player creators or hobbyist creators from doing their thing, but the ability for them to distribute their creations to other players is much more challenging than mm-hmm. what we offer in the marketplace, which means that they could probably do their own thing, but it's going to be contained within their communities and difficult to move. Yeah, I think that's about all I can really say on that stuff right there. It's a complicated topic. I think the industry is still learning a lot here, and you'll hear people say moderation and AI detection of things like that, and tools are good, but yeah, at the end of the day, it's all about, a lot of it's just brute force.
Yeah, and it requires human intervention. You bring up an interesting term in this context, right? If all these people are creating things, the promise of artificial intelligence to some degree is this democratization of content creation, which is a lot of fancy words. It's just basically saying it makes it easier. And so we could see a lot more. Do you think about that? Is that, like, let's say 10x of content is going to flood into Minecraft in the next year. Are you set up for that, or how would you deal with that?
I don't really worry about AI in terms of just flooding content in the marketplace. Our creators are already really good at doing that.
Mm-hmm. You're already overwhelmed or whatever.
So, you know, I don't think AI is going to make that have a material impact on that one. The reality, AI is such a thing right now, and it's obviously an important topic. The way I look at it is, photographers at one point had to do darkroom photography, and then they had to learn Photoshop, and that changed their workflows dramatically. Mm-hmm. Photoshop has had a whole bunch of disruptive ways that have changed the way that photographers have worked. The same thing is going to be true for a lot of digital jobs that exist today, that we're just going to have a whole bunch of new AI tools that are going to help us in our work. That's going to allow us to focus our time in some new areas and reduce our time in other areas. And as AI tools develop, it'll be interesting to figure out what are the areas that people want to spend more time in, what are the areas we want to spend less time in, and how do we allow them to optimize that. I don't think about AI as a scary thing that's going to bring floods of content into our marketplace. Again, we do manual checking of all this content, so there's human control valves in place already. But I do think about it in terms of how do we go back to my original goals of how do we make a platform easier to approach? How do we make it simpler? I already play around with ChatGPT to see if it can generate JSON structures for our query platform by reading some of our documentation that we publish right there. And that's the sort of thing that I think is really helpful. Can you give me this code snippet by telling the AI what is it going to do? And can that help somebody who may not know coding off the bat kind of get started with these sorts of things? And that's the sort of stuff that I look at there.
So it's more enablement again, rather than moderation or curation. In some ways, it seems like an ideal universe where we can just spend time together, make great things, and it's safe, and there's tools available for those of us who, like, I'm not a coder, I'm not an engineer, and that's, I can hold a conversation, but I can't really create anything. But so a no-code approach or a very low access barrier type of approach would go a long way. Do you then, from your position, look at, so what are some of the threats that you identify? Is it competitive in nature? Is it the franchise might lose its shine over time? Is it aging out? Like, how do you keep this circus going? Because it's, and circus not in a derogatory way, it's in the sense of what could stifle its ability to innovate and to, Phil Spencer likes to say, enlighten and entertain audiences. What are some of the things that keep you up in that context?
I think one of the biggest things here is Minecraft has been around for a long time. And so there's a lot of opinions of what Minecraft is. And I think when you have any successful game like Minecraft out there, the thing that makes it successful is also the thing that can make it more challenging to evolve things over time. And so I think when you look at any sort of large game like Minecraft, in order to stay around and stay relevant for many years, for many decades, it has to evolve over time. And that is really hard for games to do. So I think, sure, there are more games out there that are doing kind of UGC type things, and sure, there are more creative type games that exist. But I think ultimately games are hard. Sustaining games for a very long period of time is hard. And so there's a lot of internal things that is just hard work for us that we always need to keep working on. And figuring out what we want Minecraft to be in the future is probably one of the hardest things. And just understanding that and going for it and making sure that that is the right thing. So I think there's a million and one different ways that we could evolve the game. So, yeah.
I think that's a really fair answer. The ability to consistently innovate and keep a franchise exciting and engaging, I think that differentiates the blockbuster successes from everybody else in the context of life services, right? The expansions and engagements. You mentioned earlier Discord, for instance. Do you look at that part of the universe as well? Is that a key component where non-gameplay, where people socialize in an adjacent platform? Not necessarily Discord, but something like that, where they develop their own communities. I know Minecon is a big event every year that plays a critical role for particularly, of course, its biggest fans. So what about the auxiliary components there? Is that a beta testing thing like BlizzCon? Is that, like, how do you position that, or where does that sit in the ecosystem for you?
So in my role, I focus on a really small subset of that community. So I focus on interacting with the creator cohorts within the community. So something as big as Minecraft Live, that is targeted towards our giant player base. When I talk to communities, I'm talking to the thousands of creators out there. So it's a very smaller set of cohorts. I don't even chat on the kind of the main Minecraft Discord group, because that's where most of us mostly players. I chat where communities of creators already exist on their much smaller Discords. And so I'm not super connected to all of the community stuff that Minecraft does, but obviously, like, a game of our size has huge community outreach, lots of connections to video creators and community managers and all that kind of stuff. And of course, Minecraft Live is a big beat to engage the player base and get them excited. My stuff is only a small part of that.
As you look at the long term for some of this, if Phil Spencer calls you up and says you have unlimited budget right now, what would be the first thing or the biggest thing that you'd like to see?
Oh man, what a great question. My mind right now is sticking to tooling as a big thing. That's an area where I feel like you can be a creator on Minecraft today, but it's really hard. Like, you have to go through a lot of steps, and the things that you need to do are pretty challenging. Mm. So we have a lot long way to go there.
Tooling game, meaning what?
What's tooling? Like creator tooling. So building worlds, building scenes, connecting things together, building logic that connects all that stuff together.
Okay.
Like the scale at which our creators make stuff, it's not something you would do in game. You would want to do it via an external type application and stuff. And that's an area where, again, going back to my kind of goals, I want to make it so that people can do more with their platform. Right now, I feel like they're limited because accessing our platform can be challenging at times, and tooling mm-hmm. can solve that. But also, I feel like that for a new player, you have to learn, if you want to do logic, you got to learn some JSON, or you got to learn some JavaScript, and you got to manage all these files and put them in different places. And having some tooling that can help sort that stuff out there would make that a lot easier for newer players, kind of bring it closer to that low code or no code approach. So that for me is probably a big bucket of investment that I'd like us to move more on, so we can work towards that vision a bit more. But in terms of what's not happening yet in the UGC space, I think the next thing that we're probably missing that needs to happen in the UGC space is how do creators better manage their own distribution and marketing of their content, and how do the platforms better support that over time? Like right now, if you submit content on our platform, our marketplace, we just take care of all that stuff. We handle the editorial and all those sorts of things. But I feel like there's probably a next thing happening where creators can possibly be more involved in that. How does marketing happen? How does distribution happen? That is far beyond where we're thinking about stuff on Minecraft but maybe somewhere down the road in this UGC space. Because I think like the longer term view of UGC is, as a creator, I make content, it's mine, but how do I take some of that control and figure out how it can have legs? And maybe that means further down the road, I can make a piece of UGC content and it doesn't even have to live in just one platform anymore. Mm-hmm. It can live in different platforms, which is something that gets us closer to that metaverse-y type future type thing,
right,
that people like to bandy around. I don't know if that's going to be something that ever takes off, but
I think that's a very brave vision. The idea that you would get to a place where the content creators and the users have a bit of a preeminent position rather than the IP holders, all right? And the items and the experiences that they create could be branded, let's say, and therefore exist in multiple universes at once. So I make a cool hat, it's going to be the Yoast hat, and I'm going to be able to sell that in Fortnite and Roblox and Minecraft and everything everywhere else, basically. But it would be distributed from a central repository. If I didn't know any better, it sounds like a lot of Web3 and blockchain.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah. I don't like to pin these sorts of imaginations mm-hmm. onto technology buzzwords mm-hmm. that exist today. Same. Again, and this is so far out in terms of what anybody's thinking, but I think about, as a creator, I want to make something and I want to have more ownership over it. And that's where I think about, where can these UGC platforms evolve into the future? Because right now, it's, if you're making UGC content, you're very much making it for a singular platform today. And a lot of the value that those platforms provide is distribution and marketing and all those sorts of great
doing
things.
All of that.
Yeah, totally. Which is a huge value add that creators get a lot of value out of. But when I think about where things evolve, I can imagine that creators may want to take on more of that responsibility. And so, as a platform, how would that be possible? I have no idea how any of this could work in any sort of real sense, but I'm just spitballing some. You asked me crazy ideas.
That's why I asked, because the question is always, the people in charge, they are literally writing the script of what's next. I believe you to be one of them. And that's in many ways it's a challenging position, because what do you do? And it's so often none of that's possible for technical reasons. Like, I still have a hard time imagining a world in which any digital item can live in all of the three, let's say, online worlds that we mentioned. Because is Tim Sweeney really going to have lunch with Phil Spencer and Steve Zucchi, and they're all going to say, we should totally do that because it's to the benefit of us all? Or are they going to say, the network effects are negligible, we don't need all of our devices or all of our ecosystems to talk to each other, we're happy on our own.
And it, I mean, you know, before we get to that, we need fundamental file standards, right? Like there are some like fundamental problems that exist in a 3D tech stack before we can even talk about all these crazy stuff. It's easy for someone like Tim Sweeney to say that the metaverse is going to happen because as an owner of one of the most highly used 3D engines, they become one of the most fundamental pieces of the tech stack right there.
So, right.
Yeah, like 3D content is totally different than 2D content. Like we don't have JPEGs and HTML equivalents in 3D. Like everything is so unique. And then when you talk about games, it's not just 3D content themselves that are different, but interaction mediums and rules that are followed within that stuff. And if you start having to standardize, do you take out a lot of the fundamental joy that exists in each game? Like how much of each game is in the unique physical interaction that players and creators have in a customized 3D world? And if you standardize that, does it become less fun?
Right. You reduce the creativity.
These are really hard questions. Yeah. So hard questions.
If I didn't know any better, I would say something like, we've grown up in the games industry in these walled gardens where none of it talks to each other. And then cross-platform play is only recently really become a thing where you can play, I guess, not on mobile anymore, but you can play Fortnite on all these devices. Minecraft is really the blueprint for Microsoft, in my mind, of how that world should look. Again, like this Activision deal, like it seems, hey, here's all this content. We're going to pipe it to all these different platforms. And yet, despite that push into this platform agnostic future, the technical standards are so behind on that. Not underdeveloped, just incompatible to the degree where you really have to have this top shelf conversation with a bunch of C-suite folks to say, okay, we're really going to dedicate the next 2 years to like standardized protocols. Yeah. And technology, because otherwise we're just going to end up with four or five fiefdoms as opposed to one big universe that we can ship. I'm not a fan of the metaverse as a term.
It's a bit loaded right now. I think it officially jumped the shark when Facebook renamed themselves to Metas.
That's just because Mark Zuckerberg was insecure. He's also
I've
doing
got a lot
jiu-jitsu.
Of friends there. They're doing good work. It's all
yes,
great.
Of course. Everybody. It's not the individuals that work there. It's really I always blame leadership. With that said, there's a degree to which you get these buzzwords and it helps focus attention both on the supply and demand side. The metaverse, you also wouldn't be caught dead saying super information superhyway or cyberspace. Mm-hmm. You'd be dating yourself by 30 years and nobody would believe you after you use the word. So the metaverse is the same. It's like it will be something like that. But a nice dream to think that in the same way that the telecom companies of the world eventually figured out, yeah, we need to be able to have Verizon customers talk to AT&T subscribers because it's bullshit that you couldn't do that because these can't build a wall around them. I imagine in an online universe, 2 or 3D, that would be the same.
Yeah, like I'm hopeful that, I'm optimistic that I think the world is better with fewer walls and that over time more walls will come down. Like you said, with like cross-platform play right now, like when I started in this industry, there's no way I would have thought that cross-platform play was going to be viable. Like the fact that you could have a PlayStation user playing an Xbox user, a multiplayer game, that's amazing. I remember doing some of the first kind of cross-platform testing when I was at EA. It was Need for Speed Underground. We did PlayStation 2 to PC multiplayer stuff, and that was really hard and groundbreaking at its time. But nowadays, like as a player, like you can buy a game and play with other players across platforms, and that's almost seen as expected now, which is amazing. So hopefully we see more and more barriers collapse over time because people should be able to play games wherever they are on whatever device they are, connect with other people in these online communities, and should be with fewer barriers.
Kayla, thank you for your time. This was excellent. This was very enlightening.
My pleasure.
Enjoyed this conversation, and you've given me a lot of things to think about.
My pleasure. It's a lot of fun.
Yos, fantastic interview, and such an interestingly different perspective, I think, than the Roblox interview that we aired last month. You opened this by talking first that you want to get that mental model of how these executives are thinking about this? Are you imagining that these mental models are differentiated, dependent on the company? Or is there like a common model that you're seeing emerge? That would be my first question to you now that you've gone through a couple of these with us here on the pod.
That's a good question. So the point of interest for me is the fact that this is, you know, not a new behavior, but it's people have been making mods and creating content for other people for decades in the games industry. So that's not the new part.
It's the, what seems new is the commercialization, and the more theoretical word I might use here is the enclosure of that creative behavior toward the project of revenue generation, turning it into a business model, right?
It's the commercialization of that sort of naturally occurring effort.
Yeah, play game. Behavior, right? Yeah, absolutely.
And, okay, so this is nascent to some degree and emergent, and then it's up to decision makers in any kind of organization to shape that, to make that into a thing, to have it serve the company's needs, and also walk the line between how do you, at what point does this become exploitative? Of course, is one negative way to phrase it. But it's like, how do you keep things fun? Like, how do you maintain that and like good candor and make it, make sure that it, and ensure that if it's longevity by not having it suck. And what surprises me every time is companies are easy to blame for things. But when you talk to these individual people, I consistently get the impression that they are really good willing. Like they love games too. They're trying to do the best job. They're trying to navigate between what the company says it wants or what its shareholders want. And that's assuming that they are the bad people. And then what's fun for the players and what's creatively interesting or unique. And it's fun to, for me, it's a matter of curiosity to hear from these people that actually sit in that chair, that have to sit these meetings and have to go, we can't do this, but we can't do that. Obviously, we have to adhere to these rules. At the same time, can we do more? And so the logic that permeates, and again, the way that they describe their roles, I think that that's the most fascinating part, right? It's the what distinguishes their thought and their action in those moments as they shape it over a period of years. And then how does one company differ from the other? For instance, you take Epic. Epic is really big on pushing its Unreal Engine, and it has a very active developer community around it. That's a very different model than what Roblox is trying to accomplish. And that's a very different model than what Minecraft's trying to do. So they each bring their own sort of flavor to the user-generated content component or the creator economy. At the same time, they also have very consistent, similar qualities, right, around what's fair monetization. You always see this power curve between the number of people that actually make money and that the rest of them.
Yeah.
So there are similarities and differences. And I'm so curious, if you were to have the same conversation about free-to-play, say, a decade ago, then you would probably get a similar range of different answers. But free-to-play as a revenue model pretty much got settled on very eventually, right? And so they crystallize. And so while we're not yet at that place with the creator economy, it's very interesting to see what the different interpretations are before it crystallizes, if that makes sense.
Hmm. That's an interesting way of talking about it, because what you're basically trying to do in some sense is capture live the many possibilities that these call them business models, economic strategies, relationships, where play meets profit, whatever. Hmm. There are many possible directions they could go. There are many possible tendrils before they concretize and turn into an assumed outcome, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm sort of asking you to reflect on, are you seeing, what's sort of the category of imaginative possibilities that you see out of a company like Roblox, based on your analysis of these interviews, versus, let's say, the kind of category of imagined possibilities you see out of a company like Minecraft?
Mm-hmm. That's a tougher one. So Roblox is one that's always prided itself on its active user base. And long before it went public in 2021, it's been around for a long time. It really emphasizes that. What they do very actively in a Roblox is having these brand activations, for instance. They work very actively with all kinds of consumer-facing brands to create exposure and to sit at that intersection of player activity and the game itself and the things that you can do inside of it, and then adding this other set of voices or whatever, perspectives from brand makers and brand owners to the overall conversation. So that's very different than Minecraft. Minecraft isn't as commercially minded because it's already owned by Microsoft, and Microsoft positions Minecraft very much as like this on-ramp for its larger ecosystem of games and gaming platform. In other words, whereas I'm sure Minecraft makes lots and lots of money, the need to be profitable for Minecraft is very different than the need to be profitable for a publicly traded game company like Roblox, which really only has one title, which is Roblox, right? So it's a very different monetary framework. And from that configuration, they will position the creator economy in a very different circumstances. You could make the same argument for Fortnite, right? That one is on in its own journey, and the creator economy plays a very different role there still. So in all those scenarios, the shaping of the creator economy is interpreted very differently in my mind. And you can hear that when they talk.
So in your interviews, you often reference your son, right? Who plays in these kinds of spaces, your 10-year-old. And maybe a controversial question, but I would say, like, as a dad, where would you want your son making UGC? In which of these platforms?
That's a really good question. So ever the concerned parent, I'd be totally fine between somewhere between Roblox and Minecraft, since he's only 10. I have still an aversion of first-person shooter games, or I guess it's sort of third-person when it comes to Fortnite. But the combative exchange, which I'm aware increasingly also permeates the other two, but that's still a point of concern. I think that there's, just as a house rule, no first-person shooter games.
Oh, interesting. I didn't know that.
It's like, I get that it's on some level just like playing a game of tag. It also normalizes a sense of a degree of violence that shouldn't be normal, right? It's the geopolitical context in which we live and in which my child is growing up. Can we just ease into that? I get it. Death is part of life, but that's a little much. So I think it gets in the way of the more creative impulses that he has, to be honest. He loves to write. He loves to read. He loves to draw. And so whatever the games are that spend a huge amount of investment on developing the tools to make that, to facilitate his expression, that's the one that gets my vote. And I think Minecraft has done a really good job around that. And I think Roblox is doing a really good job with it, both in different ways, but mostly because they make it so accessible, right? It's not some like glitzy thing. It's like, they're both really just, kids don't have that aesthetic that maybe you and I have, right? Like in my world, everything has to be like 4K and beautiful. He doesn't care at all. Like, he just wants it to be blocky, which I think is sort of the secret part of success that Minecraft, but explains Minecraft. Roblox is the same. It looks terrible. As an adult, you look at it, it's like, why would you play this like knockoff Lego thing? But that's what makes it accessible to him. So those are the two ones that really stand out. It's hard to say, like, you know, other games that he'll come across. There's a lot of, he likes the totally awesome battle simulators too. Also like these wonky games. So he just likes to, play with the elasticity, and then the violence is really an afterthought as opposed to the other way around.
So for you, it's not a question about the creator experience or the monetization funnel that it takes creators on, or the revenue splits, or how, and it's not about those kinds of, let's say, the economic mechanics of how this is going on. It's more so about the sort of direct appeal, that what really do you do in Fortnite besides try to shoot people, that for you, that the sort of mechanical implications of the game are way too top heavy. On one hand, it's too much of a predisposition toward violence. Secondly, it limits the creative capacity of what you could do in the space.
Mm-hmm. Correct. It presupposes the possibility space to be geared around a narrowed down set of activities. And I don't dislike that. It's just, I would like my child to start off with as broad as a spectrum of opportunities as possible in all aspects, including gaming, right? Why limit yourself? And it's not a function of the quality of his tools and all of that, or his technology. Like, he doesn't need all the computers in all the worlds. He just needs to have something that gives him enough of a range. Fortnite is a little narrowed down. I get it. It's also a little populistic. It's pretty brand heavy in that sense. So while I like it, I think give him a couple of years. He'll get there, because you can only get older. You can't get younger. You can't move into that world and then forget all about it and go back to this sort of childhood innocence. And so I see it a little bit as my job, is to keep him there as long as I can. And so we just hardline some of these things. And that has to do less so with the violence so much as it is that it's like a limited, more limited range of activity. So now you know why we do this way that we do it. I'm going to leave it at that because it's time to go, Lane. It's time to go drink some beta versions of our eggnog that we will be serving our respective guests coming weeks.
Do you have a quick pwn for the audience?
A pwn. I do have one. Do you have an own?
I do have an own.
Okay. Let's end with your positive own. My pwn is that the Entertainment Software Association has, as of today, officially killed off E3. It's announced on Twitter.
That's a pwn?
I'm sad. For all intents and purposes, E3 was sort of the marquee annual event that determined how serious your relationship was with the games industry. Are you really an analyst if you've never been there? Are you really in the industry if you've never made it that far? As an analyst, for instance, okay, what do you really know about the games industry? You've never gone to E3, you've never met anybody. Conversely, like if you could go there, you could see the people in person, you could get the feel of what people cared about. And so it was just productively very important. And it was an event that really made a lot of big impressions on me early on in my career. If you are in the games industry and for you to get clearance, if you work at a large publisher, like you have to be senior enough, you have to matter enough to go, right? They don't send everybody there because it's expensive. It's LA, it's busy, it's crowded. It's an earned attendance for a lot of people too. And so that now is gone and GDC replaced it, but GDC is also very expensive and it's a kind of a different one. It's a little bit more internally focused.
Yeah.
The absence of that, the sort of, you know, GDC is more of a work conference, whereas E3 was a lot more celebratory. They tried like the tracks and the talks and nobody cared. It was really about show us the new toys, right? So the fact that after all this, it's now put into like a little boat onto the river and lit on fire, while perhaps several years too late, it's still a sad thing to happen.
Incredible.
So that's my point. What do you got to cheer us all up after all this death and gloom?
I got the new Steam Deck OLED, the OLED. I picked that up. I did not buy the Steam Deck when it first came out. I essentially wanted it to go through its first launch beta phase. I knew that with these kinds of technologies, there's going to be kinks to work out and things to improve and that they would do an updated release in the near term future. And I was right. And so this was the one I decided to drop for. And I got it last week, 2 weeks ago, maybe. And it's a total delight. Comes in a beautifully little custom engineered box that's lined with all the different places you can take your Steam Deck to bed, to the train, to the subway, to the toilet. It's a lovely little experience. And it feels great. It's got a really nice form factor. It's a bit wider than the OLED Switch. It's a little more comfortable in the hands. The little kind of trackpad little squares that you touch have a really nice haptic feedback. The screen is beautiful. I've mostly been using it to play Downwell. I mean, I will probably never play a game on a formal gaming computer again. Now,
A surprisingly strong endorsement.
Yeah, you know, I'm not just a hater, Yoast. I know that.
No, I didn't say, yeah, no, that's also true. No, I knew that you have a love for it. But it's like, that was a resounding yes. So I should get one.
It's a beautiful piece of equipment. I did get Baldur's Gate running. It did take an eon to download over my at-home Wi-Fi. And then I let it sit for 3 days and I was like, I'm going to play Baldur's Gate. And then it was like, we have a new update, which is another 80 gigs or whatever. So I was like, oh, cool. I guess I'm not playing Baldur's Gate. But I've gotten back into Downwell, which all that right. Beautiful little kind of platformer, which is still mesmerizes and is just so like fun and sticky. Years after that game came out, re-downloaded Firewatch. I'm like, oh, I'm finally going to finish it. I actually am using it as an opportunity to bake back through my library. Mm-hmm. And the idea that these games can now be portable, that I can play them from my sofa, I can play them in a doctor's office, it has all the, this for me is like the, I don't want VR, I want this. This is the appeal. I don't need a screen much bigger than this to have an immersive experience and really feel like connected and like I'm having a great time playing games and I can play them wherever I want. And yeah, it's a beautiful piece of hardware. It feels really good. My only, and it's not even a complaint, it's more just like a reality as a short person with small hands, I can never hit the second, like the R3 button, like on the back, mm-hmm. where you hold, but you have bumper, you have trigger one, and then you have the sort of back paddles. I can never get the very bottom one because I got these little tiny, my pinkies are too small.
No.
But I have that problem with every controller. Nothing new there. Touchscreen, I don't know. It's gorgeous. It's a lot of fun.
I'm so happy for you. This is great. What a wonderful...
Big recommendation. I got the one that was like $650. It came right away. Beautiful piece of equipment. I'm not a big gearhead. I'm not obsessed with the tech specs and stuff. It's, does this feel good? Does it make sense in the routines of my life? And does it, is it easy to use? And it hits all of those marks outstandingly.
All right then. I like this lane. I like this lane. You see how
you
that
is? This lane to show up a little more often?
I hope that Mr. Newell launches many more handhelds to satiate.
I know. Listen, I'm not thrilled having to give an A-plus report card to Valve, but they focused on doing the thing correctly and they nailed it.
That's fantastic. I love it.
Yeah.
Good for you. I'll consider getting one too. I just got a PlayStation 5, so I'm still updating my work, my life to that thing, but it's, so it might be a little too much too quick, but it sounds like this is a definite stocking stuffer this holiday season.
Yeah, just a small, inexpensive little treat to find in your stocking, right under like some walnuts and an orange, a Steam Deck. So it comes with a carrying case, which is really nice. Like the Switch doesn't, and it really should.
I like it.
Can't say enough about it. 10 out of 10.
Love 10 it. Out of 10. All right. Well, on that note.
All right. On that resounding report card, on that review, we will send everybody off. We've got, one more episode left in the season? Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
One or two? Just one. I think we're not going to do an episode the week of Christmas. So we've got one more episode ahead. Yost, are we going to do predictions again?
Next week? Sure, let's predict some stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, we can go back through last year's predictions and cook up some new ones. How about that?
And anybody who wishes us to make predictions about anything specific, hit us up in the comments and we'll review them.
All right. Amazing. With that, we'll see you next week. Good night and good game.